All right, you're listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is away today. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. That's radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram. So today, this one is for the guys. So we're going to talk about your prostate, and then we're going to talk about erectile dysfunction. And that is that's what's going on. So let's talk about, first of all, let's talk about your prostate. Prostate is a very important organ. You wouldn't be able to have prostatic fluid without it. So it is the organ that makes the fluid that carries your, that is what your semen is made of. And it is the fluid that carries sperm out of your body. Well, out of your body and to wherever it's going to go. With that prostatic fluid, that's what allows it. It allows nutrition and it carries the sperm so that if you are going to impregnate somebody, the sperm have something to live on and eat while they're traveling to hopefully become a future potential person. So it's very important fluid. So the thing about the prostate that's interesting is it is a hormonally sensitive gland. And it does respond to hormones. And what its deal is, it's where the prostate is located. It's located behind your penis and it surrounds your urethra. So because it surrounds your urethra, if everything's working normally and the prostate isn't swollen, there's no pressure on the urethra and there's no problem. And it does communicate with the urethra. So there are ducts that go into the urethra that deposit the fluid and that when semen comes out, the prostate deposits fluid and it joins with the sperm and then it's able to exit your body. So the thing about the prostate, as I said, is it is a hormonally sensitive organ. It's going to be sensitive to androgens being the hormones that we usually think of as male hormones, even though men and women both have androgens. So your testosterone, there are many androgens, but the main ones we think about are testosterone, DHEA, dihydroepiandrosterone, which comes from your adrenal glands. That is an androgen as well. And we have dihydrotestosterone as well. There are a number of other hormones that are metabolites and in the same pathways with these hormones that are also considered to be androgens. So the prostate is sensitive to all of those hormones. The prostate is also sensitive to estrogen. It is sensitive to high dihydrotestosterone. So estrogen and dihydrotestosterone can make the prostate swell. So you can get swelling hormonally, and you can also get swelling from infection and inflammation. If the prostate is already swollen hormonally, you're more likely to get a prostatitis, which is where there's communication between the urethra and the prostate and microorganisms get in. And that is something that can happen. And if you have an enlargement of your prostate, you're more likely to have that happen. So how does the prostate get big in the first place, and why does it tend to happen in older men and not so much in younger men? Well, I think that the testosterone, regular old testosterone, keeps the prostate in line. Part of it has to do with time on the planet. And so the more time you spend on the planet, the more likely you are to be exposed to estrogen and estrogen-like compounds. Unfortunately, estrogen-like compounds come from the environment. There are what we call xenoestrogens in the environment. Xeno is a word that means foreign. And so it's a compound that comes from outside the body and mimics estrogen. And there are receptors on the prostate that can bind those hormones. And estrogen is a proliferative hormone. So it makes the prostate grow. If estrogen itself binds to the prostate, or if estrogen-like compounds bind to the prostate can grow and swell. So you may have heard the term BPH. BPH, we used to think it stood for benign prostatic hypertrophy. But hypertrophy actually means that the organ is growing, that the cells are growing in size, and that's not actually what's happening. What's actually happening is benign prostatic hyperplasia. Hyperplasia means an increase in cells. So when those estrogen-like compounds or estrogen itself or dihydrotestosterone binds to the prostate, you get an increase in the number of cells in the prostate. So that's something that's hard to deal with because now you have more cells and you have to set up a situation where the prostate doesn't feel like it has to keep making more cells. And so why are you getting xenoestrogens in the first place? Well, there's a number of reasons. Xenoestrogens and estrogens and dihydrotestosterone, why is that happening? Well, guys, like women, can have hormonal imbalances, and those hormonal imbalances get worse as we get older. Your testosterone levels decline, and your straight-up testosterone is going to help to support the prostate in staying at a healthy size. Whereas, when women get become estrogen dominant, that means usually what you're talking about with estrogen dominance is you're talking about a relative or even absolute excess of estrogen relative to progesterone and other hormones. When you have too much estrogen, what you have going on is you have too much tissue growth, you get swelling, and you get irritability. That can certainly happen in men as well. So you can have a relative estrogen excess and you can have an absolute estrogen excess in men. And sometimes if you measure men's estrogen, it'll be elevated. You'll actually see that. You can also do testing for men to see where their hormones are in relationship to each other and see if they are, in fact, measurably estrogen dominant. If you have an enlarged prostate, then you probably have some level of estrogen dominance, whether it's from actual estrogen, a relative testosterone decrease, or it's because xenoestrogens are affecting your prostate and causing it to grow. So what do you do about that? Well, one of the problems is we live in the world. We live in an environment. There's stuff in the environment. If you live in a place where you're using city water, for example, city water is usually very good at filtering out all substances, but because there's so many substances going into city water, sometimes it can be hard for city sewer supplies to filter out all of the substances that are in the water. So you can get very tiny doses of things like drugs, drugs that people take, SSRIs or any drugs at all that people take. And you can also get very tiny doses of hormones. Hormones can be in the water supply. That is one way that it happens. There's also hormones, xenoestrogens in the environment, whether you're using plastics, so obviously we all know about BPA, bisphenol A, which is thought to be a xenoestrogen. And it's thought that other plastics as well can cause cellular growth. So if you're using a lot of plastics, that's one situation that can happen. If you are not eating organic produce and you are getting pesticides into your body, pesticides can be xenoestrogens, and they can mimic estrogen and they can stimulate estrogen receptors and cause the prostate to grow. You can simply have a clogged liver. So in order to manage your hormones and have a healthy level of all different kinds of hormones, your liver has to be functioning in a healthful way. And your liver, if you live in the world, has a lot to do. The liver is an amazing organ. And I'll repeat what Dr. Titchard said, who was my anatomy professor back at NCNM, which is now NUNM. Dr. Titchard used to say he didn't think letters should be signed "Love, Fran." They should be signed "Hepatically Yours, Fran," because he thought the liver was the most important organ in the body. Hepatic is a Greek term for the liver. So hepatitis, that means you have an inflamed liver, and the hepat part is how you say liver in Greek. The amazing thing about the liver is if you look at a liver's enormous. Your liver is on the right side of your abdomen. It does stretch across to the left, and it takes up a lot of space because it has a lot to do. The neat thing about the liver is that every single cell in the liver is exactly like every other cell, and every one of those cells does a bazillion things. It's really cool. So one of the things that the liver does is process a lot of your macronutrients. It processes your proteins and puts them together in forms that you can then use to build tissue in the rest of your body. It processes fats. It emulsifies them and, again, sends them out to the body so it can be used to make things like cell membranes and hormones. And it processes carbohydrates by it stores them. It stores them as glycogen. It processes them. It releases the glycogen as you need it by putting sugar into your blood when you need it. So it's processing all of your macronutrients. It's also processing a lot of your vitamins and minerals, and it's processing any toxins that go into your body or any and lots of metabolic substances that go into your body. Your liver doesn't really know the difference between a toxin and not a toxin. It just sees something going through and it metabolizes it. Now, there are certain metabolites that are more toxic to the liver than others. One good example of that is alcohol. That's why if you drink too much alcohol, it's bad for your liver. That if too much alcohol goes through and it's you send it through at a rate that the liver can't process it as fast as it's coming through, the alcohol hangs around. It has alcohol itself, ethyl alcohol itself, is damaging to the liver. And then as alcohol goes through its metabolic stages, it can be damaging to liver cells. So as alcohol gets transformed from ethyl alcohol to one of its intermediary stages, acetylene, acetylene is it's a three carbon compound, and those three carbon compounds it's a triple bonded compound, and triple bonded compounds don't like to exist in nature. They're not stable, so they fall apart. And when they fall apart, if you are drinking too much alcohol and you get too much acetylene in your liver, because your liver can't process it down to acetic acid, vinegar, and water, and finally down to carbon dioxide and water, you'll have these intermediate metabolites, which are unstable, and they cause free radical damage. They cause oxidative damage to the liver, and they can hurt cells. So the more alcohol you drink, the more likely you are to have hormonal imbalance. So drinking too much alcohol can give you hormonal imbalances. And one of the classic things you see is estrogenation of people who drink too much alcohol. And what you'll see in men, like men who are alcoholics, they'll have signs of estrogen dominance. For example, they'll have breast development. That's one of the things that you'll see. That's a sign that your estrogen is too high. Drinking too much, I'm not saying that drinking a little bit of alcohol is going to do this to yourself, but if you regularly drink enough alcohol, where you become drunk or you're just drinking a lot of alcohol, that damages your livers. So that intermediary step is called an aldehyde when it's an aldehyde. So acetylene, another name for acetylene is acetaldehyde, and it's one of the intermediary steps of the metabolism of alcohol. So as anything that damages your liver is going to make it so you don't process your hormones as well or anything else. Another thing that can make you not as good at processing things with your liver is too much starch and sugar. If you overeat starch and sugar, especially sugar, but starchy foods too. If you eat way too much starch and sugar, your liver has to process all of those starches and it has to store them, and it stores them as glycogen. And if the glycogen stores are full, then the liver is going to start converting those. What happens is when you have too much starch and sugar in your body, your insulin rises. And your insulin rises because insulin is a big traffic director and it responds to the presence of sugar. And it goes, okay, what are we going to do with the sugar? Either we're going to take the sugar and we're going to take it out of the circulation, we're going to drive it into cells. When the cells are too full of sugar and there's no cells for the sugar to get into because they're all full up, then it's going to send it somewhere else. And so the first thing it'll do is store that sugar as glycogen in the liver. And then once the glycogen stores are replete, it's going to turn the sugar into fat. And you're going to have increased triglycerides. So you're going to have increased blood fats. And the other thing that's going to happen is the sugars that are in the liver are going to go into storage mode because there's too much insulin. Because if your insulin's too high, it's going to drive the conversion of sugar into fats, and that happens in your liver. And when you have too much sugar turning into fat in your liver, then you get a fatty liver. And fatty liver, you get fat taking up space in your liver, and it takes the place of liver cells. And then you have less liver cells. So when you have less liver cells, you have less cells to manage your hormones. So eating too much starch and sugar can raise your estrogen too much. So if you have PMS, or if you have uterine fibroids, if you have endometriosis, too much starch and sugar is not good for you. If you have breast cancer, or if you're trying to prevent breast cancer, too much starch and sugar is not good for you for that reason and a number of other reasons. Also, if your prostate is too big, too much starch and sugar will make your prostate bigger because you can't manage your hormones as well and you're going to tend to be estrogen dominant. That's how that works. So working on your starch and sugar can help with that. So how do you work on your starch and sugar? If part of the reason that your prostate is enlarged is because you have too many xenoestrogens in the environment, and the other thing that can raise your that can enlarge the size of your prostate is stress. Good old stress. Now, why would it do that? Because stress, when you have stress, your adrenals kick out a hormone called cortisol, and cortisol tends to dominate, and it's a steroid hormone just like all of your reproductive hormones. So it's a steroid hormone just like estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, DHEA, and all their analogs and metabolites. And so cortisol, and it's in a pathway with those as well. So you can take progesterone, and with an easy two-step process, you can turn it into cortisol. So cortisol will be present when your mind is going, okay, I'm under stress. And that stress can be anything. It can be a good stress, like you're preparing for your child's wedding or your bar mitzvah. It could be that you have a deadline at work. It could be that you're caregiving to someone who's ill. So any kind of stress can raise your cortisol. And cortisol is suppressive. It dominates and is suppressive to the reproductive hormones because basically nature is interested in you surviving. So either, in order to survive, you're either going to be running away from the bear or the thing that's chasing you, or you're going to be making a new version of you. So you're not going to do both. So cortisol is neat. If your body thinks you're under danger, it's going to make cortisol, and the cortisol is going to suppress your reproductive cycle. And also, you're going to take elements of your reproductive cycle and turn them into cortisol. So you don't have as much reproductive hormone around. And then you have cortisol. So then you get more hormonal imbalances. So one of the things that happens is when you're cortisol dominant is that cortisol, again, one of cortisol's jobs is to look around, find tissue, break it down, and turn it into sugar, put it in your blood so you have energy to run away from that bear. Okay, it doesn't care why you're stressed. It thinks you're running away from a bear. You're running away from danger. And so cortisol tends to raise your blood sugar. So if you're under chronic stress, your blood sugar's a little high, you have too much insulin. Now the insulin's going to convert whatever sugar's around into fats, get the high triglycerides. You might also get the fatty liver. And then the liver is not working as well, and it's not managing your hormones as well. So stress, and if you have a lot of cortisol, your liver just has to process the cortisol too. So your liver's taken up with that, and it's not able to manage your hormones as well. So high stress will give you a big prostate. Another interesting thing that will give you a big prostate is not using your prostate. So men who do not have sexual release, who do not have orgasms, are more likely to get enlarged prostates, and they are more likely to get prostate cancer because you have to clear the pipes out. If you've got fluid that's just sitting there and you've got compounds that are coming and going through that prostate, and the pipes are not cleaned out, you're more likely to have stuff just sitting there and able to cause oxidative damage. So you have to think about where the prostate resides. The prostate, as I said, wraps around the urethra and has a communication with the urethra so that it can insert fluid into the urethra. It shares a wall with your rectum. So that's why when you go and have a prostate exam at the doctor's office, the doctor will insert her finger into your rectum and find your prostate and make sure that it's not too big. You can usually feel it. It feels kind of mushy. And you look around. Well, you don't look. You feel with your finger, and you're looking for any unusual masses or enlarged size or anything concerning while you're also asking the guy, are you having any symptoms? So you guys probably know the symptoms of an enlarged prostate because the prostate is wrapped around the urethra. If it's enlarged, it's going to put pressure on that urethra, and it's going to make it so you might have trouble starting and stopping your flow of urine. When there's pressure on that urethra, we hope that it's not choked off completely. Usually it isn't, but there's pressure on it. So because there's pressure on it, you might feel like you have to go to the bathroom all the time, and you go to the bathroom for small amounts because that pressure on the urethra is going to give you the sensation like you have to urinate. So that's one thing that happens. Another thing that happens is if you really have to go, you go and you stand over the toilet or the urinal, and you find that you just can't get going. It's difficult to start going because the pressure isn't enough to get past the stricture that's being caused by the pressure on that prostate. And then once you get it going, the pressure as it comes through is enough for you to urinate. But because that cavity is narrow where the urethra is with the prostate around it, you get dribbling. So that's how that happens. A lot of fun, right? So you probably want to know, I mean, this is not a great situation. And you guys who have issues with your prostate, you're probably not real thrilled with it. And as we get older, it's not so unusual. And it happens when we get older because of your declining testosterone, your relative estrogen dominance, more time on the planet being exposed to xenoestrogens. It may be more likely to happen if you don't exercise a lot. If you have an enlarged prostate, it's possible that you have a reduced sex drive, so you're not having sex as much, or you're not helping yourself out as much either. So if you're not having as much sexual release as you used to have, that's another thing that contributes to it. So guys, have some fun because that actually helps the health of your prostate to clear it out. So, of course, and there's a corollary to that, which is erectile dysfunction, which we're going to touch on next. Anyway, if you have an enlarged prostate, what's the goal? The goal is you want to have that prostate shrink. You want to have less cells and a smaller size of the prostate so it can relax, so your urethra doesn't have to be impinged upon, and so that prostate isn't enlarged and gummed up so that you're more likely to get a prostatitis. A prostatitis is basically a UTI for a guy, but often it's the prostate that gets infected, and it gets infected because of that communication between the prostate and the urethra. There can be bacteria that goes back and forth. The other thing I wanted to say about the fact that the prostate shares a wall with the rectum is if your bowels are not regular, you may have a situation where you have stool that's sitting waiting to come out. And, if it's not enough stool, or you have issues with how frequently you go, you can have stool that's sitting up against that shared wall with the prostate. So there, the stool is supposed to come out of your body. So if you have regular bowel movements 1 to 3 times a day, you're going to be less likely to have the situation. But if you go less than once a day, there's going to be a period of time where you have stool that's sitting on that shared wall with the prostate. And there can be toxins that your body intended for exit from the body there are capillaries there, and there are places for those compounds to get in, and the compounds can ultimately make it into the prostate. So you got to be pooping regularly. If you're constipated, that's something to really work on. Constipation, or not having regular bowel movements, is a contributor to an enlarged prostate. So if you're constipated and you have an enlarged prostate, you got to work on the constipation. So how do you work on the constipation? You have to figure out if you're eating foods that are making you constipated. Are you eating too much gluten? Are you eating too much starch and sugar? Are you not eating enough produce? Are you not eating enough stuff that has probiotic in it, like fermented foods or just good organic produce? Fruits and vegetables are a great way to help you be regular. So are things like ground flax seeds. I love ground flax seeds and chia seeds, especially chia seeds, because chia seeds will suck toxins out of your system. If you have poor quality microorganisms in your digestive system, chia seeds will help to suck them out because they just absorb so much water. And they get, when you eat chia seeds or you suck on them, they get slimy. And when they get into your system, they draw a lot of water to them. So they make your stools softer and easier to pass. And they'll draw toxins out of your system more readily. And they will help in making you more regular. And if you have constipation for any reason, there can be many reasons why you have constipation. One of them can be that you're hypothyroid. So if you haven't had your thyroid checked in a long time and you're constipated, you might want to get that checked out. Again, a lot of times it's just people aren't eating enough food. If you find that coffee helps you be more regular, then and you don't have any other health issues with the coffee, if you drink organic coffee and that makes you regular, go for it, because that can be helpful. And there are studies on coffee. If coffee doesn't bother you, if coffee doesn't give you headaches and doesn't give you heart rhythm abnormalities, organic coffee can be helpful in moving bile through your system. It does stimulate your colon to work. It stimulates your biliary, your whole biliary system. So your whole liver and gallbladder and pancreas, they all will be stimulated by the use of coffee. So if you don't have health effects from the coffee, then drink organic coffee and it can help you be more regular. If you're me and you drink regular coffee and your metabolism isn't cranking because you went on a long bike ride that day, you'll get a stomach ache from the coffee. So if coffee gives you bad symptoms, by all means, find other ways to get your caffeine if you're going to get caffeine at all. Because, you know, I know for me, caffeine is, it irritates my stomach or coffee particularly irritates my stomach if I have too much, even though I love it. I love to have a nice cup of coffee, but if I have too much coffee too many days in a row, I will get a stomach ache. And if that's you, then you don't want to use coffee for that purpose, or you want to use it in moderation or find ways to prepare it so that you don't get stomach discomfort. I have to have space between my days of drinking coffee, and when I drink coffee, I have to limit how much caffeine I have. So I hear people say, oh, I just have two or three cups of coffee a day, which if you are not super caffeine sensitive, is perfectly fine. If you're me, I would be so sick if I had two or three cups of coffee in a day. I'd have horrible headaches. I'd be nauseous. It would be just, I mean, it's bad enough. There are some days when I have 8 ounces of coffee and that's enough to upset my stomach for the whole day. And the interesting thing is when I drink coffee in the morning, I still feel the effects of it 6 hours, you know, 8 hours later. So I had a nice cup of coffee, went to the Grover's Mill Cafe in New Jersey on Monday morning, and I had a cup of coffee, and I had a half. I had 12 ounces, which means I had 6 ounces of full-strength caffeinated coffee and 6 ounces of decaf. And I drank that black, and I think when I drink it black, it's worse because there's no fat in the coffee, no fat or protein to slow down the absorption of the caffeine. So I think I'd do a little bit better if I have a latte or, you know, some kind of milk or dairy substitute in my caffeinated beverage, and it slows the absorption down. So, but if I have full strength coffee and it's, you know, and it's not, there's nothing in it to slow it down, I had that coffee probably at 10 o'clock. And I looked at the clock at 6 o'clock at night. I was driving around. I was home already. And I was driving around realizing, wow, I still feel the effects of that caffeine 8 hours later. So that means that I have a slow functioning CYP1A2 gene, that my gene functions slowly. And a little caffeine for me goes a long way, which means for exercise performance, it's a good thing. I have just a little bit, but I have to really ration it. You know, especially on a day when I'm not going to be getting exercise and I'm sitting in the car the whole time, it's probably not the best thing for me to have a cup of coffee, even though it tastes so good. What can I say? So having said that, when you drink coffee, if you don't have bad side effects from it, the good things it can do is, as I said, it stimulates your biliary system. It can make you more regular. And it also helps you regulate blood sugar. It can reduce your risk for diabetes. It also can reduce your risk for gallstones. So ultimately, because it makes your liver work better, if it doesn't slow your liver functioning down like it would with me, because my body can't process the caffeine quickly. So that will actually, it's questionable. Like people who are slow metabolizers of caffeine, is it really good for them to eat? Is it really, or consume? Is it really good for their livers? Because your liver doesn't have the resources to detoxify it. So your liver gets slowed down and taken up with taking care of this compound with limited resources. And so it's not as available to do other things. And I know that if I drink too much caffeine, it will make me more estrogen dominant. And some women find that that's the case. If they drink caffeine, it makes their PMS worse. It makes their fibroids worse, or any symptoms of high estrogen, it makes them worse. And that's usually because they're slow metabolizers of caffeine. And because when you're slow metabolizers of caffeine, you have this gene called CYP1A2 that expresses the production of your phosphodiesterase. Or your adenosine. There's an enzyme system that breaks down caffeine, and it controls the expression of this enzyme. If you are a slow metabolizer, you don't express the enzyme. The gene doesn't express the enzyme as well as someone who's a fast metabolizer. So you have less enzyme around with fewer resources. So the cells are working really hard with their lower supply of enzymes. And you have this caffeine that's backed up, sitting around. So it's still running through your blood, stimulating your organs and your nerves and mostly your blood vessels, and causing vasoconstriction and vasodilation in ways that maybe aren't good for you, and stimulating your heart to beat faster and raising your blood pressure and things like that. So there's a backup. And your liver is working really hard to take care of this caffeine. It might not be as available, again, to take care of your hormones, because, like I said, all of those cells are exactly the same as all the other cells. So if they're presented with caffeine, they're going to break down the caffeine. If they're presented with, here, store this vitamin B12, they're going to do that. If they're presented with some starch and sugar, they're going to go, okay, let's make that into glycogen. So the more you give them to do, the busier they're going to be, the less they can do, that something's going to have to give. So if you overload yourself with something that the liver is not going to have the resources to deal with, like too much alcohol or too much caffeine or too much starch and sugar, liver's not going to be able to do what you want it to do. And in the case of your prostate, what you want it to do is metabolize your extra estrogen, your xenoestrogen, and your dihydrotestosterone, so you don't have hormones stimulating the growth of that prostate. So you want to have a really well-functioning liver. And again, if you're constipated, that's a sign that your liver is sluggish. And so you want to get that liver going. And if you, like I said, if you metabolize caffeine well, coffee is a good way to do that. If not, you might want to go for green tea. There are many herbs that can help with liver function, like milk thistle, like chelidonium, like artichoke, like burdock, like dandelion root. These are all great liver herbs that can be taken in capsules and pills and tinctures and in phytosome forms, where they're linked to phosphatidylcholine, which is a compound that the liver really loves to use because it helps to create more liver cells. It's really good stuff. So having good liver function is one way to reduce the size of your prostate. Then there are things you do to increase the excretion of actual estrogen and xenoestrogens. So one of those is this compound called I3C. I3C is found in cruciferous vegetables. Cruciferous vegetables are vegetables in what we call the mustard family or the brassica family. So they're going to be your kale, collards, bok choy, chard, mustard greens, your broccoli and cauliflower. Those are all in they're all in the brassica family. And the vegetable that has the highest level of I3C in it is broccoli sprouts. Apparently at the sprouting stage, there's a lot of I3C present. And the neat thing about I3C is it encourages the excretion of estrogens. And so that's a really helpful thing to have. So if you eat a lot of cruciferous vegetables, that's going to help you to excrete your extra estrogens. Cruciferous vegetables are really great in terms of helping you excrete the extra estrogens, helping you detoxify, and they're great anti-cancer vegetables. So cabbage also is a cruciferous vegetable. So all of those things are going to help you with their I3C, broccoli in particular, and broccoli sprouts even more so. And so I3C, the metabolite of I3C that does the most excreting of estrogen for you is going to be DIM, or diindolylmethane. And diindolyl methane is the metabolite that actively really helps to escort extra estrogen out of your body. There are foods that you can eat that are known to do well to excrete extra estrogen, including, in addition to the cruciferous vegetables, sesame seeds and anything made from sesame seeds. So sesame seeds and sesame butter help to excrete extra estrogen, and so do ground flax seeds. They help you to excrete extra estrogen. So if you like sesame seeds, you're not allergic to them, that's something you can add to your diet that's going to help to lower your estrogen status and possibly help you to have better testosterone function and have a smaller prostate. So very basic things you can do to decrease the size of your prostate. Like I said, eat cruciferous vegetables. If you get your hands on broccoli sprouts, great. You can take supplements that have the herbs I mentioned in them. You can take DIM supplements that have I3C. There's also supplements that have DIM, and they'll have combinations of things. Then there's herbs that you can use that manipulate you hormonally, and one of them is saw palmetto. So saw palmetto affects how much dihydrotestosterone you make. So it blocks the production of dihydrotestosterone. That's how it works, and so it goes after an enzyme that does that. So saw palmetto has classically been used to help to shrink the size of the prostate. And then pygium is another herb that is helpful in that way. And then so is pumpkin seed. Pumpkin seed oil has also been shown to decrease the size of the prostate. I don't know that it's through the hormonal way of helping it as much as it's an anti-inflammatory, and it has, and these things have zinc in them, and zinc helps with things with zinc help with the metabolism of androgens. So those herbs can directly be helpful for helping the prostate to shrink. Good urinary tonics can be helpful too. I would consider using things like corn silk and hydrangea for a man who had problems with the urinary flow because of the prostate. But hormonally, you're looking at pygium and pumpkin seed oil and also saw palmetto. Another herb that has been used in men to decrease the size of their prostate, as well as in women to reduce hot flashes, is Swedish flower pollen extract. You have to take a decent amount of it, so it can get expensive, but Swedish flower pollen extract has been studied to help to shrink the prostate because of how it works with hormones. So it's a nice thing. There's other things I like to make sure to let you know to do. And one of the things that's going to improve your hormonal status and flush things out is exercise. If you get regular exercise, you just plain get more circulation going through everything. So if you have more circulation going through your liver as well as your kidneys, you're going to have more opportunity for those organs to cause detoxification to occur. So when you do exercise, your heart rate speeds up. So you have many more cycles of blood through the organs of detoxification. And if you then supplement with water, because you're going to be sweating some of that fluid out, and you supplement with fresh water. So now the water, hopefully you're going to have a source of water that doesn't have any toxins in it. Sweating is one way to get rid of some of the toxins that are in your body, and then you replace it with clean water, and then your toxin level is lower, so you have less toxins in your body. As your blood cycles through your kidneys, liver, and lymphatics, those organs are going to use their enzymatic processes to pull, it's really the kidneys and the liver have enzymes in them to help to pull toxins out of your body, and then they send them back. The kidneys will send them into your urinary tract, and the liver is going to send it into your bowels, and you're going to excrete that way. These organs are called the emunctories. So if these organs are working better, again, you're going to have better prostatic function. You're going to be able to manage your hormones better. Drinking lots of water helps all of these organs to work better because then it has more substrate to make bile and also to make urine to send things out. And so the organs work more efficiently if you're well hydrated. And so getting exercise can absolutely help to shrink your prostate because of the many more times that your blood gets cycled through your liver and your kidneys and your lymphatics, so that it's going to pull out excess hormones, and that will help to shrink the size of your prostate. So reducing stress, however you like to reduce stress, whether it's, leisure walks in nature, meditation, Tai Chi, going to church, taking naps, doing less stuff, using essential oils, getting a massage, getting a pedicure, any of your methods of reducing your stress, hanging out with your pets, hanging out with your kids, not hanging out with your kids, hanging out with your partner, not hanging out with your partner, whichever one works for you, being intimate, physical closeness, whether it's snuggling, cuddling, holding hands, or even intercourse. And as we said, intercourse, specifically having an orgasm for a man, is going to clean out the pipes. It's going to make you less likely to have issues with your prostates because you're clearing everything out and you're giving the prostate an opportunity to clear out the extra hormones that are sitting in the fluid and to start again. And you're just keeping things flushed. You'll also be less likely to get prostatitis and prostate cancer if you have regular orgasms. So there's a reason to do that. Let me see. Another thing I like to mention is sitz baths. So sitz baths are a good old-fashioned naturopathic hydrotherapy treatment, or I should say a good old-fashioned hydrotherapy treatment because, practitioners who are not naturopathic physicians will recommend sitz baths. Sitz baths are good for lots of things. So it's basically a bath where you're sitting in, it can be a specialized tub that you can affix to your toilet. It's just a little thing you sit in that you put water in and you can put it on your toilet. So it's on top of something that's easy to sit on. And because it has water in it, you want it to be in the bathroom. You can also improvise a sitz bath for your tub. So you can put the tub, if you have a bathtub, you can fill the tub up part way. The point is you want to be covered in water from your waist to mid-thigh, and that's it. And so that's going to manipulate circulation in your pelvis, and you want it to just be there. So if you're in your bathtub, you don't want to have your feet in the bathtub. If you want to be in the actual bathtub proper, you can sit in the tub. So you're in water up to your waist, and your pelvis is covered up to your thighs. And then if you want, you can drape your legs over the side of the tub. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to put a smaller tub into the bathtub. So once again, you can be covered from your waist to your mid thigh, and you can drape your legs over the side of that tub. Another thing to do is you can buy little contraptions that are designated for sitz baths that you can buy and you can affix to your toilet, or you can put in your bathtub and you can sit in those. So a great thing to do is alternating sitz baths. So you do 3 minutes of as hot as you can stand, and you fill it up with water, and you're going to be sitting, whichever method you're using, you're going to be sitting in the water for 3 minutes, then 30 seconds cold. And how hot? As hot as you can stand. How cold? As cold as you can stand. So if that means not very hot, then do that. If it means not very cold, then do that. As you get used to doing sitz baths, you'll find that you can handle extremes of temperature. And in hydrotherapy, when you can handle more extremes of temperature, we see that as a sign that your constitution is getting stronger. So be gentle with those structures down there, and obviously don't burn yourself. So sit in a bath that's going to be warm enough that it's comfortable, hot enough that you can stand, but not so hot that you burn yourself, obviously, and not so hot that you can't stand it, and then cold enough so that you can get into it, and then you're not going to be running shrieking from it. So you're going to do 3 minutes hot, 30 seconds cold, and alternate three times. And what does that alternating do? That alternating creates a flushing action of your circulation. So it's going to move circulation more rapidly just right through the organs that you need it, through your actual prostate, through your kidneys, through your liver, through your whole biliary system, through your digestive system. So when you do the alternating hot and cold, you get that flushing action. So guys with enlarged prostates might find that their prostates shrink just from doing that. I've had patients in the past who, if they're willing to do a sitz bath, it can really help. Because the thing is, what your MD is going to do, if he hears that you have an enlarged prostate, either he's going to give you an alpha-2 adrenergic agonist, or he's like tamsulosin, your Flomax, things like that, the things that end in ocean, like tamsulosin, that's one of them, and or he's going to give you a hormonal modulator like finasteride, which is an antagonist of 5-adiol G, which is going to make it so that you don't make as much dihydrotestosterone. So you have more testosterone around and less dihydrotestosterone, which can produce a favorable environment for the shrinking of the prostate. Only problem with that is once in a while, you have a subpopulation of men who have a sensitivity to those drugs, those 5-ADG inhibitors like finasteride and dutasteride, where they get an irreversible genetic expression where they stop expressing adequate levels of the reproductive hormones, including testosterone, and they get a lot of side effects from it. So you have to be careful taking those drugs. That's why I like to have men, because you didn't get an enlarged prostate because you have a deficiency of dutasteride and finasteride. You got your enlarged prostate because of, you know, as we said, time on the planet, lifestyle factors, things like that. So doing conservative measures can be really effective. Doing your sitz baths, having regular orgasms, eating lots of fruits and vegetables, making sure that you're having regular bowel movements, not eating as much starch and sugar. All of those things can really help. And taking simple things like I3C and DIM and the herbs we mentioned, like salt palmetto and pygium and pumpkin seed oil, and even just good old fish oil because it's anti-inflammatory and helps regulate hormones as well. And then doing chia seeds and flax seeds. All of those are great simple things that can help. Drinking less alcohol, and eating really good food. Those simple measures can really work very nicely to help to shrink your prostate, so you don't have to take a drug that has harsh side effects. And your tamsulosin and stuff, alpha-adrenergic agonist can have side effects too. One of the things you can get is anticholinergic side effects, like, guess what? Constipation, sweating, insomnia, racing heart, high blood pressure, all kinds of stuff like that, which you don't want. If you absolutely have to take a pharmaceutical med, I'm not going to stop you. But I just want to let you know that there's a lot of natural things you can do to shrink the size of your prostate. So what's a PSA? That's prostatic specific antigen. When the prostate is inflamed, not necessarily cancerous, but when it's inflamed, your PSA will tend to go up. And men, it's controversial whether PSA is a useful marker for prostate cancer at this time. But if your PSA is elevated, it's a good idea to get it investigated. And if your PSA is much above 4, your urologist is probably going to want to biopsy your prostate. And of course, biopsying the prostate is controversial because then it might not work as well. And, there's sensitive nerve tissues there. And so that's why conservative measures are a really good idea. Like get it while your PSA is low. And if you have any kind of enlargement in your prostate, take care of it early, as soon as you start to see signs of that. In fact, even if you don't have signs of it, do things to take care of your hormonal and prostate health. If you take care of your hormonal health, your prostate will be happy too. And then everything will work better. So we talked to you about a lot of really great things having to do with the prostate. I'm thinking that in terms of erectile dysfunction, I only have 9 minutes left because I talked so long about this. So I'm thinking I'm going to leave that for next week. Let's go on to just a cute little topic, which is going to be very appropriate because we're going to go down, some areas are going to go down to freezing tonight. So I decided to talk about why soup is good for you. Yay, soup. So I recommend eating soup. There's a lot of reasons why soup in general is good food. And the first reason today why soup is good food is because it's cold out there. And it's going to go down to, if not freezing, it's going to go down to near freezing. If you're listening out in Norfolk or in Colebrook, it's not Coldbrook, but it might as well be, right? I think the coldest place in the state is Norfolk. And Norfolk and Colebrook, they're kind of right next to each other, right in that far northwest corner, but right just to the east of it. There's that little cold place, like when you're headed for Torrington, you go through, or Salisbury, you go through Colebrook and Norfolk. And if there's if it snowed and other places in the state the snow's melted, it won't have melted there because it just sticks up. I think there's an elevation issue. It's heading into the Berkshires right there. It's this little cold spot. So if anybody's going to get the freezing there, they're going to. But we might see frost tonight. So, and then tomorrow, I don't think we may not even see 50 degrees tomorrow. We're going to top out in the 40s tomorrow. Just like that, October 18th, brr, right? So you might want to eat some soup. So here's the thing. I was talking with somebody yesterday about the benefits of eating raw versus cooked foods. And my opinion is when you eat raw foods, and especially when you're eating raw vegetables, there are benefits you get from raw vegetables. When you eat raw vegetables, you have to chew them, and you have to chew them a lot because the nutrients are inside the cell walls. We do not have cellulase enzymes in our bodies to break down the cell walls, and that's why some people recommend to take enzymes. You can take cellulase enzyme orally, and then you're more like a cow because a cow has cellulase. You know, the animals that are herbivores have cellulase enzyme in their bodies. They make it in their bodies. We don't. And so if you don't take an extra enzyme, then you have to chew your food really well because the good stuff that's in your vegetables are inside the cell walls and you have to break them down using your teeth. So chew, 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 chew if you're going to eat raw vegetables. That's why it's also nice if you're going to eat salad, you might want to consider chopping it because then it's in smaller bite-sized pieces and you've done some of the work of chewing by cutting it up. So instead of having your salad in big leaves, you put it through a food processor, or you can just use a knife and cut it small. And you're going to the nice thing about chopped salad is you get all the yummy salad ingredients in one bite because you can mix it all together. So when you eat raw vegetables, you maintain there are certain vitamins and minerals, not so much minerals, but vitamins that are going to be more bioavailable. And mostly your water-soluble vitamins, they can be affected by heat. They're going to be more bioavailable. And also, your enzymes are going to be more intact. When you start heating up enzymes, they start denaturing and changing their state. And you don't get as many of them when you cook food. On the other hand, when you cook food, now in Chinese medicine, they don't believe in eating raw food. They think it's too taxing to the spleen and it causes dampness accumulating and it's too taxing to the triple warmer. So it's taxing to your body. So they believe that your body has to work too hard to warm up the food so it can use it. And they have a point, especially when it's cold and damp out. It might be hard on your body to process a salad and might be a little bit easier to process something that's been heated up. Think about how warm and soothing a nice stir fry or a soup feels when you're in this kind of weather. So the advantage to heating it up is when you heat it, guess what? You're using heat to distress those cell walls. So it's easier to get inside them. So when you go to chew your broccoli or your leafy green or your carrot, it's easier to chew it. It's easier to break into those cell walls and there's some things you're going to get more readily. Carotenoids, your beta carotene, your lutein, zeaxanthin, alpha carotene, gamma carotene, all your carotenoids are more bioavailable with cooking. Lycopene is also a carotenoid. That's why the best way to get lycopene from a food is tomato juice because it's been pasteurized. So heavy cooking of greens and carrots and squash, things that have that have carotenoids in them. Cooking makes them more bioavailable because you're distressing the cell walls. So that's a reason to eat soup because if you eat soup, it's going to have that stuff in it. Here's some benefits of soup. One of them is it tastes good. No kidding. So unless it doesn't, because you could have soup that doesn't taste good, but it is easy to make a good tasting soup with only a few ingredients. And sometimes you can get soup made by local establishments as long as it's healthy. You can go to the Willimantic Food Co-op or you can go to health food stores and they have prepared soup for you and it's very good. And then you don't have to cook and you heat it up and off you go. They make lovely soup as well at the fish market in Willimantic. You can get gumbo there. You can get New England clam chowder. You can get Rhode Island clam chowder there. So New England clam chowder, you probably know, is a milk base. And Rhode Island clam chowder has a clear broth base. So those are very good. Soup is good for your health. One, if you eat bone broth especially, it's very good for your health. It's a good way to get the benefits of the carotenoids that are in the soup. Soup can help you lose weight. One of the ways it helps you lose weight is because it's filling. It's just a volumetrics thing. There's that whole book about volumetrics, how you eat a lot of food that has a lot of volume but not a lot of calories. Well, soup fits the bill there, especially if it's not a cream soup. If it's a soup with a lot of veggies that has a basic veggie base or even a meat base and has a lot of vegetables in it, soup is very filling just because when you have all that liquid, it hits your pressure receptors in your tummy and you're not going to want to eat as much. I know for myself, I thought, you know, a pint of soup isn't going to have a lot of calories in it. And I had a pint of soup and a salad, and that was way too much for me. I just didn't feel good after that. So if I have soup and salad, I have a cup of soup and then the salad. And then, you know, my tummy can handle that. As we just said, soup makes you feel full because the weight of the soup hits your pressure receptors in your tummy and you don't feel like eating as much. It's not very expensive. You buy some vegetables. You can even buy some fruit. You can make a broth and people feel full, and you can make a soup and it's very nourishing and healing. You can save it for tomorrow and have more soup tomorrow. Chicken soup. So for example, when you eat chicken soup, soup is great for when you're sick because it's easy to digest, especially if you do chicken soup when you do bone broth, or even if you just do a chicken soup where you make a stock and you're using bones in the stock, you're going to get immune globulins when you get the immune globulins. So it's the other thing, when you cook chicken meat and also bones for a long time, the immune globulins in the flesh and also in the bones themselves become more bioavailable. And that's part of why chicken soup is good for you when you're sick. It literally helps your immune system. So at my recommendation is good to go find some soup, either make it or find some that's good. Is soup in a can good for you? Soup in a can is not going to be as good for you as freshly made soup, because soup in a can has been pasteurized. You don't know what ingredients are in it. However, if you're sick and you don't feel like making it and that's what you got, consider soup in a can. Consider soup in a jar that has really good ingredients in it, that's organic, and it's still going to be very nice and soothing for you. All right. Well, guess what? That was fun. So I talked about the prostate and I talked about why it's good to eat soup today. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath. This is a call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I'm Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. I'd like to let you know I will be at the Mansfield Community Center tonight and at 10 Eagleville Road. In 10 South Eagleville Road in Mansfield. And I'll be there at 6:30 tonight, and we'll be talking about intermittent fasting. So if you're interested, you can come around and see what it's all about. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs.